Thank you, brethren, for helping us to get off to a good start. And there is a handout, and so while it's being passed, I have some more love to convey to the convention. Brother Bill and Sister Ellie Rosmus, Brother Larry and Sister Mariana Davis, and brethren in Cluj, Romania, Sister Catherine Hunter from Steubenville, Ohio, the Northwest Indiana Ecclesia, Metropolitan Illinois Ecclesia, Brother Walter Wessel, Brother Leonard and Sister Josephine Wessel, Sister Wanda J., Brother Tony and Sister Harriet Simonis, Sister Mary Geisinger, and the Jersey City Ecclesia. Always nice to have more love than we have time for. So we took it off of Brother David's time, and his assigned title was The Inspiring Examples of Faith. Brother David.
Brother Earl said that if you don't have a handout, hold your hand up and he'll get one to you. Nice to be back. Your brethren who live in and around Louisville send their love to you. My mother, most especially, would have liked to have been here, but she's certainly not up to an 8-hour drive, so. But she's here in spirit. I feel a little superfluous right now. I think everything I'm going to say has been said. However, those of you who have been in the truth for a little while, I'm sure you realize that you start personalizing the truth, and I think that's important. So you end up saying things a little differently from somebody else, and that's not going out of the truth. That's not despising the harvest message. That's just personalizing it. And even that, I think, is an element of faith. I have to question myself frequently. Everybody says it this way. I say it this way. It's not really that different. But am I going someplace I shouldn't be going? And that's an element of faith for everyone who speaks from this platform. All right. I understand the brethren received questions and outlines for their talks. I never got it. I think that's because I'm not on email. But I don't think that'll make a whole lot of difference. At least not today. Tomorrow it might. Obviously, from the title that was assigned to me, Hebrews 11 has to be a factor. So let's sort of start there. Maybe even end up there. And see what happens. We obviously know that one of our objectives in life is to be pleasing to God. Hebrews 11:6 points that out. It's actually in the discussion of Enoch that it takes Enoch's experience and states that he was pleasing to God. That's how verse 5 ends. And then the apostle takes the time to comment on that. And without faith, it is impossible to please him. So obviously, one of our objectives is to be pleasing to God. It is this means having faith. If we are pleasing to God, according to Hebrews 11:6, 5 and 6, it means we have faith. If we are pleasing to God, it means we have faith. If we have faith, it means we are pleasing to God. They become synonyms. We are going to, I don't have one of those outlines, but I don't think I need it. Yes, I do. The first part is the lead into Hebrews 11. I want to mention, first of all, the Elijah factor from 1 Kings 6. I think Brother Bob brought it up. I never read this. I even have a hard time talking about it because whenever I do, I just sort of burst into tears. It is, as far as my faith is concerned, one of those invisible realities. And I noticed as we were coming from the motel this morning to 119 to turn left, wonderful hills surrounding all of Uniontown. And I just can't help but remember that Elisha story. All the angels on the chariots right there on the ridge. Absolutely marvelous. And for me, it is the whole question of faith is best summarized by this conviction of being surrounded by inevitable success. If indeed we believe that it's there. That is, for me, a very, very much a reality of daily life. And I think as you try to exercise faith on a daily basis, just try to see what isn't there. I mean, you might not have hills where you live, so look on the rooftops. The fact is, they're there. And there's over 100 million angels, according to Revelation. Myriads times myriads and thousands of thousands. Now, there aren't that many spirit begotten around. But Hebrews 2 says, are they not all ministers of the saints? So I'm not convinced you have only a guardian angel. I think there are multitudes of them. I just cannot help on a daily basis. Again, I'm just repeating myself. But isn't it wonderful if we can feel like Elisha? I mean, there's his poor little servant, and they've got enemies surrounding them. And the poor servant says to Elisha, I think we have a problem. And you can just see in your mind's eye Elisha smiling and say, Lord, let him see. Such a dramatic moment. And we've got to have that mind of Elisha where when we're with our brethren, if they express some sort of doubt, Lord, let him see. Okay. Texts which prepare us for Hebrews 11. Let's go back and see some things that lead in. There is a reason for Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11 is not there just because Paul decides he wants to talk about faith for a moment. Matter of fact, the entire book of Hebrews is about our part with our Lord in the sin offering and the eventual blessing of all the families of the earth through the new covenant. And in essence, he says, you're going to need some faith to prepare yourself for this. And so a lot of things lead up to Hebrews 11 and come out of Hebrews 11. So let's just touch on a few of them. 2:16. There is no 2:16. Yes, there is a 2:16. You remember chapter 2, which contains my favorite text in the whole Bible, where Paul says in one translation, somebody said someplace. Don't you love that? I do because I can never find out where anything is. But then he quotes Psalm 8, which is all about the kingdom, and he says, we really don't see that yet. We just see Jesus who was made like Adam so he could die and open the way for the kingdom. But he's saying, all these angels I've been talking about in chapter 1, they are not going to be the ones that administer the kingdom. So when we get to 2:16, it says, for assuredly, he does not enlist help from angels, but he enlists the descendants of Abraham. Just love those. Who does Jesus take hold on? Who does he enlist for the administration of the kingdom? It is you. Because you are the seed of Abraham. It's a dramatic text. If we believe it, what a basis for faith it is. If we don't believe it, we're like a lot of nominal Christians that say, I'm going to leave a nice life and go to heaven. That is an attitude we never want to have. I'm going to lead a nice life and go to heaven. The faith element is here. He has grabbed hold of you. He has enlisted you as the seed of Abraham, which will bless all the families of the earth. What a faith element. Chapter 3, verses 1, 2, and 6. Therefore, holy brethren, because of what we just talked about, therefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession. He has become our head. Therefore, we're going to consider him. He was, the next word is, faithful. Now, faith and faithful may not equate in your minds, but they are very much the same. Faithful is being full of faith. And Jesus being faithful to God is because he had faith in God. So faithfulness is introduced here, and with it, faith is introduced. Jesus was faithful to him who made him, as Moses also was in all his house. Verse 6. But Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are if we hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm until the end. Wow. Notice the words. Be analytical here. Christ was faithful as a son over his house. Now, here's one of these places where I personalize the truth. And maybe you don't see it exactly like this, but to me, the house is a covenant relationship. When Paul is talking about houses in the whole book of Hebrews, he is talking about covenant relationships. Moses was faithful in his house. That was the law covenant relationship. The house that we are part of is the Sarah covenant relationship. But Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are. Sarah covenant. If, and here's the faith part, if we hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm until the end. Confidence is faith. We will be part of the Sarah covenant if we hold fast our faith, and I love the next phrase, the boast of our hope. Boasting is admonished by the Apostle Paul. And it's admonished by God. Boast in God. And the boast of our hope is, he has asked me to listen to him, to follow him, to grow in him, and eventually to be used in the administration of the kingdom. If we hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm until the end, definitely a faith text. 4:1-2. Therefore, let us fear. This word means alarmed. Be alarmed. Therefore, let us be alarmed, lest while a promise remains of entering his rest, any of you should seem to have come short of it. For indeed, we have had good news preached to us, just as they also, meaning the Jews. But the word they heard did not profit them because it was not united by faith in those who heard. Paul is doing an equality here at the beginning of the Jewish age and the beginning of the gospel age. He's saying in both cases, the Jews and we have the gospel preached to us. Remember the gospel was first preached unto Abraham? But it said it was not united with faith unto them. He says, this is the difference. This is the entire difference. This is the thing that is going to make us either successful or not successful. Faith, which the Jews did not have in the gospel that was preached to them. 9:14. This is a long context, so I can't get into the whole thing, but you will notice in chapter 9 several times the word conscience comes in. So I want to talk about conscience before I read the verse. Your conscience is what allows you to do something. Now, in this whole context of Hebrews 9, it is talking about our part in being the goat of the sin offering. He says, you have to have an honest-to-goodness, clean conscience before you are ever going to consider walking into the Most Holy. Nobody just walked into the Most Holy. You did. If you did it unwisely, it was the end of your experience. So Paul says, look, you've got to have a conscience here that is clean enough to get you as part of the sin offering into the Most Holy. 9:14. How much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works, that's the law, to serve the living God, the reality, not the time. So the question for us, and again, I said we don't have time to discuss this whole thing here, but the question for us is your conscience such that you will allow your blood to go into the Most Holy? That's a faith item. That should shake you up a little bit. 10:19. Since, therefore, brethren, we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus. So after long discussion here, we're already in the next chapter. He says, indeed, if you've caught what I said, if you do understand that you're part of the Lord's goat, he says, you do have this confidence to enter the Most Holy. By a new and living way which he inaugurated for us. Verse 23. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. He says, you have now started on this course. You intend to be slain as part of the Lord's goat. You intend for your blood to be taken into the Most Holy as part of the sin offering. And you notice the word he uses, confidence. I know it's not faith, but Paul uses a lot of synonyms in the book of Hebrews about faith, or a lot of closely related words. And he says, this is what you must maintain. He is saying, you are entering the holiest of all callings. Do you have enough faith to get you through it? This is all leading to chapter 11 and chapter 12. 10:35-39. If you don't mind, I'm going to read a paraphrase of that. I like to paraphrase things simply because it's personalizing the truth. I'm not trying to change the scriptures, I'm trying to put into them they mean to me. Hebrews 10:35-39, paraphrased. This camaraderie of saints in the pursuit of being a faithful sin offering is the basis of our confidence, which we must never discard, because we need the long-term future endurance which this camaraderie supplies. Step aside for a moment. He's talking about the fact that you will not have the faith. You will not have the long-term endurance without the body. This is not an individual pursuit. It's the blood of the goat, not of the blood of Brother John Smith, that goes into the Most Holy. Thus, when we collectively, we will have fulfilled this will of God for human sacrifice, we also will collectively receive the resulting promise that we will bless all the families of the earth. Habakkuk 2, 3, and 4 express well what I am trying to teach. Now Paul, in verse 37, quotes from Habakkuk. Even with what might seem like long-term endurance, it will be only a little while until our hopes will find fulfillment in Jesus' return. Until then, he who intends to continue as one of my justified ones will do so by his continuance in faith. Anyone who does not will find that I will leave him in my displeasure over his lack of faith. End of quote from Habakkuk by Paul. You see the premium he puts on faith and on continuance in faith. On the fact that it may seem like long-term endurance, but it'll only be a short while. Continuing in verse 39, we, the body of Christ, are not those who shrink back, resulting in destruction. We are those who have our beings preserved because we will continue in the exercise of faith, which I now wish to expand upon for your benefit. You can see how all of this leads us to chapter 11. That's how Paul gets to chapter 11. He says you have the most sublime calling in the history of the universe. Faith is at the bottom of it. I want to encourage faith in you. Let's first look at faith in those before you. And that brings us to chapter 11. Now, Roman numeral 2 on your outline. I was going to say more about 35 to 39, but I think I won't for time's sake. Some chapter 11 concepts. I don't know if any of the brethren failed to talk about Hebrews 11:1 today. I don't think so. I will say something slightly different about it. Faith is defined in two parts. The two parts to me are this. Number one, if we have faith, the things for which we hope, though they are yet future, are compelling reality to us. To me, that's what the word substance means. Substance is something you can grab a hold of. And he's saying you can actually grab a hold of something that isn't there yet. That's substance in faith. It's not substance in reality. In reality, you have to be able to grab it. But in faith, it is saying it is so much a part of your reality that you can call it substance. If we have faith, the things for which we hope, though they are yet future, are compelling reality to us. Second point. If we have faith, we have a total conviction of the existence of things which are not visible to us. You see the two parts? The first is things which simply aren't there yet, but they're reality to us. They're substance. We can grab a hold of them. The second part is they are there already. You just can't see them. Like God, like Jesus, like the angels, and so on. Two parts. The things that are coming, that are real to us, the things that you can't see that are real to us. Those are the two parts of faith. And those two things are manifest in the lives of these ancients that get mentioned in the rest of Hebrews 11. Now, I want to go to the end of Hebrews 11, which Brother Austin touched on. I have to admit, at the end of Brother Austin's study, I said, no, why are you talking about that? I want to talk about that. The two categories of faith in our lives. But it bears repeating. 11:33 and 34. who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to fight. That's the kind of faith everybody likes to talk about. Ah, I did it. I did it. It was great. But that is not Paul's point. And he makes us understand that very convincingly, because now he has the second list, 35 to 38. Women received back their dead only in the promise of resurrection. Others were tortured, not accepting their release in order that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins, in goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, wandering in deserts, in mountains, in caves, in holes in the ground. Would you brag about that kind of result for your faith? I don't think so. I have faith. Look what it brought me. I was sawn in two. But this is Paul's point. He says, faith is not shown by results. That's important in our lives. Terribly important in our lives. Verse 40, because God had provided some better thing for us, so that apart from us they should not be made perfect. Now, if their reward depends on us, how much faith must we have? Another point. I think in many translations, the whole 11th chapter is deficient. It should really read in faith, not by faith. I hope that you can see immediately the difference in those two little prepositions. If you say, by faith, I slew a lion, that works. No matter what's behind it. Or you take one of those bad examples. By faith, I got sawn in two. It is rather in faith. And I like the best Brother Megason's use of it. He says, expanding on it slightly, and it's what I use because this is how I personalize it. In a life of faith. And I think this is the real foundation, the real emphasis, the real focus in chapter 11. It is not by faith these people did these things. It is in a life of faith these things were committed to them. Very, very big difference. Fourth point. In each one of these cases, when these ancients were faithful, they became prophets. You may have missed that when you read through. But if you think about every one of them, it is implied in the description of them. Because they had a life of faith, the Lord allowed them to be prophetic. Sometimes allegorically, by the fact that their life represented something, allegorically or typically. Sometimes because they actually were able to make statements that were prophetic. But that says something about us also. This is why the saints in the New Testament can be called prophets. Because if we are living up to our faith, the Lord will make a prophet out of you. Not a seer, but a person who understands the future and who can explain it. A great honor that comes from living a life in faith. Point number five. It is interesting to note as you read through Hebrews 11 that the examples given are not what we would usually cite in their lives. If I were to ask you about faith in the life of any one of these people, the chances are you would give a totally different example from the one the Apostle Paul used. And that, in the end, can be very revealing also. We'll see why as we look at some of them. And point number six. God knows our faith. He allows it that we can prove it to ourselves, thus enhancing our confidence in God. In other words, when we say God tests our faith, I don't think it's saying that God's going to say, let me see what happens if I do this to him. Believe it or not, God's bigger than that. He's omniscient. He knows your faith, which is why he called you in the first place. What he wants to do is show you and me that we actually have faith, because it's important to us to know that. And so all of these things are done. Our growth in faith, our experiences in faith are done to show us, oh my, I did have faith. And thereby increasing our confidence in God dramatically. All right, Roman number three on your outline. Some points regarding the ancient worthies. Please remember, it is not what they did by faith that's works, but what they received because of faith. I have a whole list of them there. I'm not going to read through all of them, I don't think. But making some points about them. Paul says, and in a number of cases here, I'm going to paraphrase rather than quote. But with Abel, he says that Abel was granted to offer a better sacrifice. You know, very frequently we talk about Abel saying, God accepted the sacrifice because it was typical. That's not Paul's point at all. Paul's point was Abel had had a life in faith, therefore God so arranged that he's the one that gave the acceptable offering. It's a totally different thought. It's totally backwards from what we normally interpret it to be. Abel was in a life of faith, therefore he was granted to offer a better or prophetic sacrifice. The implications for us are strong. If we are living a life in faith, we will be granted to offer a good sacrifice. Enoch was blessed. Because he lived a life in faith, he was blessed by being removed. Obviously, he didn't remove himself, so he didn't do this by faith. It was in a life of faith that he was blessed by being removed. According to Jude 14, he was a prophet. The implications for us are the same. 11:7, Noah, because he had a life in faith, was warned. I'm using specific verbs here to show you why God did what God did, not what Noah did, not what Enoch did, not what Abel did. Because if you read these accounts carefully, it's not about what they did. It's about what God did for them because they lived lives in faith. Noah was warned. He also became a prophet, Matthew 24:38. 11:8, Abraham was invited. I'm going to use a phrase, faith gene. Somebody said earlier that faith tends to run in families, and of course it goes out of families too, but it does run in families. And I don't know whether it's genetic or not, but the fact is some families have faith, and some families don't have faith. And there is a faith gene in the Bible. By the way, Sarah was Abraham's sister, happened to be his wife too, but apparently the faith gene ran in that family pretty well. But keep this in mind. When God invited Abraham to leave the Chaldees, Abraham was a heathen. His father was a heathen. He was a heathen. There was something about the fact, though, that this man had a faith gene, and God looked and saw this in him, and he said, come here. This is when Abraham starts to know the God, not all the gods around him in this heathen land. I mean, somehow we make some giant leap of faith here that the whole land was heathen and Abraham was a worshiper of Jehovah. No. Abraham was as heathen as anybody else, but he had this strong faith gene. He was invited because of it. And he said immediately, yes. By the way, this is what he has in common with Rahab. These were both heathens. Abraham and Rahab were heathens. But when the true God talked to them, they recognized the true voice. Okay, he became a prophet also, allegorically, according to Galatians 4. 11, 9, and 10, Isaac and Jacob, they had that same familial faith gene. And what happened as a result? They were promised. I hope you see the tenor of where I'm going, because this could be very boring. I'm just going down a list. But I'm not telling you what they did by faith. What I'm reporting is that because they lived a life in faith, they had that built-in faith gene. God did something to them or for them. Isaac and Jacob were promised. 11:11, Sarah was blessed with the promised seed, and she likewise became a prophet. I won't keep saying become a prophet, because it goes on, et cetera, all the way through. The fact is, every one of these became prophets because they lived lives in faith. I'm not defining faith very well, because normally we take these people and we say, they had faith, this is why they did this. No. They lived a life that already contained faith, and therefore God allowed them to do these things. Totally different focus. 11:12, the Abraham-Sarah team, they were promised. Hence we get the two seed salvations. Abraham again in 17 through 19. He proved to himself God was not proving to God that Abraham had faith, but Abraham was proving to himself that he had faith. And he demonstrated it by the depth of what he could do. You know, it's hard to put words in other people's mouths. But when each one of these things in Abraham's life finished, Abraham probably said something like, gee, I didn't know I could do that. I hope that's our experience in our Christian way. After we come through something, and we've seen the Lord's hand in it, we can say to Him, Lord, I didn't know I could do that, but I see with Your help that I can. And that strengthens the faith as it grows. The next three, verses 20 through 22, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, all of them were allowed to prophesy because they lived lives in faith. In 11, 24 to 28, we have Moses. He was allowed to claim his heritage. He was allowed to see Messiah. By the way, just as a reference to the chart, plain in, justification plain. Sometimes we say it is a consecration to righteousness, which it is. But there are people in the world who are atheists who are consecrated to righteousness. So I think plain in needs a slight extra definition to it. This is not only consecration to righteousness, but acceptance of the promised seed. Obviously, the ancients could not accept Jesus because he hadn't been there yet. But they accepted the promise that was made in Eden. The seed of the woman will bruise the serpent's head. Moses saw Messiah prophetically. He knew there was to be a seed of deliverance, and he believed in it. And he was honored to conduct the Passover prophecy. These are things that were done for him, to him, and through him, not by him. Even Israel is mentioned in verse 28, because they maintained faith in a deliverer. So they were allowed to be prophetic by passing through the sea. And the last two that we receive any information about, because Paul does a little cataloging there later. The last two are Joshua and Rahab. Joshua, who isn't even mentioned there, by the way, says, by faith, the walls of Jericho came tumbling down. Well, I'll tell you a secret. The walls didn't have any faith. So it's talking about Joshua in a life of faith, even though his name is not mentioned. But he became a pictorial prophet by what he did. And here again, I want to put a little warning out, because I almost fell into this trap myself. About Brother Russell's interpretation of Joshua and the walls came tumbling down. You know, 6 days they walked around it and blew trumpets. 7th day they went around it and blew it 7 times. The walls finally came tumbling down. I have heard probably many, 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 many more brethren than not saying that that represents the 7 stages in the church. And that's not Brother Russell's thought at all. And it bothered me, I was probably 18, it bothered me, because there was something that didn't fit about that last day. Brother Russell says this represents the 7 millennia of the 7th creative day. That God's message threatened error in each one of them. And it is the combination of all of the truths of all of those millennia that focus in the 7th day for the destruction of everything that is threatening to God's people. It does not represent the 7 stages of the church. It's easy to see why you get into that, because you get trumpets and all that, which sounds like the 7 stages of the church. But don't look for it in Brother Russell's writings. He didn't believe that. Rahab, in a life of faith, was given the honor of welcoming God's people. I always wonder why certain things are last. And the last two that Paul expands upon are Joshua and Rahab, where he gives specific examples in their experiences. And here's my answer to that. I don't know whether it's right or not. I think these two accounts, Joshua with the walls, Rahab with the welcoming of God's people, these two accounts picture the final fulfillments of the Abrahamic promise for the world. 1, the falling of the walls opens the way for the new covenant, so the people will inherit the land. 2, Rahab's actions show the resulting conversion of unbelievers, which she was, and the destruction of those who will not hear that prophet, which those that lived in Jericho would not do. So I think it's showing the fulfillment of how the whole Abrahamic promise that came out of Abraham will meet its glorious beginnings. The falling of the walls, and finally the heathen welcoming God. some New Testament times examples. I may actually have time to go back and cover that one thing I said I wouldn't do. Let's go with this first. Examples you have known. I don't want to take these out of Scripture. I just want to take them out of your recollection. And the first four I will mention are all dead, because it's easier to talk about dead people. I don't want to embarrass anybody in the room, because I know that you know a lot of faith examples in this room. Let me take some faith examples. In a life of faith, Ludlow Loomis. Now, you can finish that almost any way you want to. Was provided for by God. Ludlow Loomis was one of the most impractical men I ever knew. And you know, brethren, think you ought to be a deacon before you're going to be an elder. Ludlow would have made a horrible deacon. He wouldn't know how to open a door. I'm not being critical, but if you knew and loved him, you sort of loved him for it. I mean, he was just really an impractical man. But he lived a life of faith, and he trusted God. And every step of the way, when he saw that he had to do something, his question was not, how will I be fed? How will I be clothed? How will I be housed? Where will I work? No. His question is, was it the right thing to do? And he did it. And in a life of faith, God took care of it in every single example. Peter Coloman. I'm only going to mention one thing. If I gave a verse like Paul does in Hebrews 11. Peter Coloman. In a life of faith, was granted to marry Mirza because he couldn't knock on the door himself. He said that to me. And I heard him say it to others. He said, you know, people think that I'm really good at going out and witnessing. He says, I can't do it. My knees shake. He says, I take Mirza and she knocks on the door and she gets the conversation started and then I enter it. It was a wonderful admission. Because all of us know Peter Coloman is the man who could witness to anybody. Well, not according to Peter. But in his life of faith, the Lord gave him somebody who knew how to get the conversation going. In a life of faith, Carl Hagensick went through Iron Curtain boundaries without things he should have and with things he shouldn't have. Probably knowing that it was not terribly likely he was going to make it past the gate. And I think of one instance that he told me. Somewhere, I don't even remember the country anymore, but there he was, ready to go through customs, and he starts talking to the man in front of him. And they had a nice conversation, and Carl had stuff with him that should not go past that border. He didn't know what was going to happen when he got to the customs man. Well, it so happens that this man in front of him goes through this border on a regular basis, and he gets there, and he says to the custom man, don't bother with him, he's a friend of mine. And so Carl walks right through. But so, what is that? In a life of faith, the Lord granted that Carl could break barriers. Carl didn't do it. And Sister Luella Harp, which probably most of you never knew. She had a very humble estimate of herself. I think eighth grade is all she went through. I always told Carol, if I got stranded on a desert island, she's the one I'd want to be there with because she's the most practical, resourceful person I ever knew. But she did not always understand things that came by, even though she believed the truth fervently. And in a life of faith, she was permitted, in her own little way, to say, bring that by again slow. And I really appreciate that. When anything was a question for her, she would say to the elder or the person she was talking about, bring that by again slow. Maybe I can get it the second time. And she usually got the point. So you've known, and you do know, many examples of faith. And it's what the Lord provides for them, not by them, that counts. In the New Testament, Timothy, good example. Paul says in Timothy, don't be motivated by the spirit of fear. You know, Paul needed a little help there in Rome. He was in prison. And basically he says to Timothy, I need some things. There's a coat I would really like to have. And there's some books I really need for reference sake. He said, but the parchments, especially the parchments. Paul needed some paper. He wanted to write something. And I think that was the book of Hebrews. So in a life of faith, God permitted Timothy to bring the parchments to Paul, and we have the book of Hebrews. Nathanael. What a marvelous, marvelous character. In a life of faith, he just had so much faith that he didn't need prompting. You know, Jesus said, oh yes, I saw you praying under the tree. You're Messiah. Now, that wouldn't convince many of us. But there was something that in his life of faith, he was given the ability to recognize important truths as they passed by him nonchalantly. The Ethiopian. He's asked, you understand what you're reading? How can I unless some man teach me? Remember that, brethren. There are a whole bunch of foolish people out there who say, you're following a man. In a life of faith, the Ethiopian was permitted to see that he needed a teacher. And I'm sure he got the truth as a result. How can I understand unless some man teach me? It's a scriptural principle. And it takes faith to realize it and to believe it. And the centurion in Matthew 8. Remember, Jesus said, I'll come to your house and heal your daughter or your servant. I don't know which it was. It doesn't matter. The centurion says, I've been a ruler over men. I know how it works. You don't have to come to my house. Just give the order and it'll be done. And Jesus responds, I have not seen such great faith in all of Israel. So in a life of faith, I suspect that this was probably Cornelius, eventually rewarded for it. In a life of faith, this centurion was permitted to have his family deal, his servants deal. And probably eventually to get the truth as a result. So, you know, I have not said much about developing faith. I haven't said anything about developing faith. So I'm really going to oversimplify it. Have it. Have a life of faith. Have a life in faith. And the Lord will do all these other things that are worthy of having a Hebrews 11 chapter written about you. Because as we'll see tomorrow in chapter 12, our faith is different from those of the angels. Let me give you two living examples just to close. And as I said before, you know many and I'm looking at many. Sister Jane Henderson, in our ecclesia, you don't know her, she doesn't get out much. You might have met her at a Dallas convention if you've been there, or Huntsville. That's about the only place she gets to. There was someone in our ecclesia once that had pretty much hook, line, and sinker fallen for the call is over theory. And been over for a long time. And Jane, who is someplace in southern Indiana, her roots, she's a lot like Luella. People in southern Indiana have these nice ways of saying things that gets right to the point of things. Anyway, then it comes to the calling. Jane says, look, I didn't ask to be called. I didn't want to be called, but I was called. And in the life of faith, she was able to realize, just from her own experience, that the whole doctrine of a closed door just didn't work. She didn't ask to be called. She didn't want to be called. But there was no denying she was called. And the last one shows you how the Lord can overcome the absolute impossible. Sister Vicki Flood, she'd gone through all, probably born a Baptist, but she's gone through all Pentecostal churches and everything else. And she was really bothered by the hellfire stuff. And so she says, Lord, I want to know the truth on this, and I don't know how to find the truth on this. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. It's Sunday morning. I'm going to turn the channel thing and let it stop on some channel, and whatever the preacher is saying, that's what I'm going to take as your word on the subject. So, she turns the channel, turns on the TV, and there's George Wilmot talking about the truth about hell. I know it's implausible, but the Lord loved it. In a life of faith, she found the right channel. May the Lord add his blessing.
Thank you, Brother David. In faith, inspiring examples of faith. We would like to close with the second two verses, the last two verses of hymn number 198, after which we would ask Brother David to close in prayer, after which we'll ask Brother George Shuck to read the songs in the night for us, after which we have a couple announcements. So I may not ask you to stand on the final verse. That's what I'm trying to say. 198, 3 and 4.
Beloved Father, we wish to please Thee with our faith. Help it to grow always into the likeness of Thy dear Son, Jesus. Please bless us with the results of a good faith. And we ask in Jesus' name.